Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juneau, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Matthew with Sending of the Twelve. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. We've been studying the Gospel of Matthew chapter 9, and we've seen the Lord heal many sick people, such as a paralyzed man, a woman with an issue of blood, a girl who was so sick everyone thought she was dead, two blind men, and a demon-possessed mute man. And he healed and taught in many cities and villages. When he saw the multitudes coming, he had compassion on them, since they were like sheep without shepherds to care for them. And today he speaks to his disciples regarding his compassion on the people. As we start out today in Matthew chapter 9 and verse 37. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few." And the way he put this in Greek, he used the men de construction, which means on the one hand and on the other. So he says, on the one hand, the harvest is plenteous, but on the other hand, the laborers are few. So where were all the shepherds? Well, as I said last time, many of the shepherds were just taking advantage of the sheep. The Herods were in charge of Israel at this time and didn't really care so much about the people. The religious leaders just wanted to enrich and empower themselves. So where were all the laborers for God? He says the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Now, I hear many people quote this passage, and it's obvious they would like to think that harvests are always plenteous. But that's not so. Sometimes harvests are great, but at other times they're very sparse. For example, consider when God called the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah went out and spoke to the people, and generally no one listened to him. Now, at first, early in his ministry, he went and he spoke in the temple. And the people all had him arrested. And the religious leaders, the priests, they had him arrested. They were furious and they wanted him executed. And the only thing that spared his life was the fact that some of the princes of the household of David listened to Jeremiah and took his word seriously and took his side. So the princes protected him so he wasn't executed. But later in his ministry, no one would listen to him. And in spite of the fact that he warned them over and over about the coming Babylonian destruction, they wouldn't hear him. Well, Babylon destroyed the nation, and the few people left, he told them, "Stay in the land and God will bless you." And they still didn't listen to him. They left and went to Egypt, took him with them. In Egypt, he told them, "Stop serving these false gods and serve the Lord." And they said, "We didn't listen to you before, and we aren't going to listen to you now." And so poor Jeremiah lived at a time when the harvest was very, very poor. But what was important was that he served God faithfully, whether the harvest was poor or good. So I can't guarantee anyone that you're going to go into a plentiful harvest. Some harvests are plentiful, and some are scarce. Now, at this time in Israel, when the Lord was saying this, the harvest was great, and that was good. However, he says the laborers are few. Now, laborers in the fields in Israel were often hired servants. And understand, everything, as I've told you before, was run on the family system. And you wanted to be part of a family. But if you weren't part of some family in charge of a household, and you had to be a servant, well, what you'd want to be would be a household servant, because then you'd have permanent work attached to a household. But if you weren't attached to a household, you could be a hired servant, a day laborer hired for the day. And that's very unsteady employment, and that's why you'd want to be a household servant. But the hired servants would be hired for the daily tasks of the harvest. And they would find their best work at important times like harvest time. However, at this time, while many might have been ready for literal harvests, few, it seems, were ready for God to hire them. Now, many missionary organizations like to use this verse today and say the harvest is plentiful. And sometimes it is. Not always. Sometimes it is. Certainly sometimes true the harvest is plentiful, but it certainly is often true as well the second part, that the laborers are few. And whether you're talking about the mission field or whether you're talking about here at home, It seems there are always fewer laborers than there is work to do. There's so much work that could be done for God, and so few laborers to do it. And sadly, it seems that Satan's agents are always all too willing to step in and steal the harvest when the laborers are lacking. So even today, it's a good idea to pray for God to send more laborers into his harvest. And certainly to pray for a plentiful harvest. Like I said, it's not always plentiful. We could pray that it is. So verse 38, therefore pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. And this happened, and this was realized within 2 years after this, when at Pentecost, the laborers were greatly increased. Now this, send out laborers into the harvest, the word for send can also have a violent connotation. Drive laborers forth into the harvest. Give them a little choice. Drive them out. Make them go to the harvest. And you say, well, when in the world would God ever drive laborers into his harvest? Well, understand, that's how it was with his apostle Paul. Consider 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 16, where Paul says of himself, for if I preach or proclaim the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yes, woe is me if I do not proclaim the gospel. So Paul says, God has called me as his apostle, and he leaves me no choice. I have to go out and proclaim the gospel. It's laid upon me, necessity. I can't do anything else. So God did drive out laborers into his harvest, and thanks to the work that was done in the Acts period, an enormous harvest was gathered in. However, this is not always the case, and we could certainly pray today for more laborers. Well, that closes out Matthew chapter 9, and now we get to the very important Matthew chapter 10, and the sending of the 12, the commissioning and sending of the 12. And I'm sure we'll be considering this important chapter of Matthew 10 for quite a few sessions. But in Matthew 10 and verse 1, it says, and when he had called his 12 disciples to him, he gave them power over unclean spirits, to cast them out and to heal all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease. So the Lord calls his 12 disciples to him. Now we need to understand this because many people get the mistaken idea that all the Lord had was 12 disciples. But no, in fact, he had many disciples. Hundreds sometimes, it seems. Although at Pentecost, there's only 120 left. Well, that was after his death and resurrection. But when they didn't know he was going to rise, many of them had probably scattered. So he always had more than 12 disciples, at least 10 times more, if not more than that. But the 12 were a special group of 12 that he picked out of the other disciples. Now, there are several times when it talks about the Lord calling the 12, and in some of the other Gospels, it talks about him going up on a mountain and praying, and then calling to him 12 of his disciples. And so it seems that was when he officially chose them. But interestingly, as far as I can tell by working out the chronology, this is earlier than that event. So this almost seems to be a trial run for these 12 who were officially chosen as his special 12 later. So this is maybe a trial run of the first choosing of them that I can see. Now he calls these 12 disciples to him and he gives them power. And that is actually the Greek word exousia, which means delegated authority. Of course, it's not their power inherently, but they're getting this power from the Lord. He's delegating it to them. It's his power, and he's giving it to them. Now, the power is over several things. One is unclean spirits. Now, while I believe that these are probably very much the same thing as demons, they're not called that here. This is a different term for evil spirits, and it's calling them unclean spirits. Now, I believe that these were fallen spirits. God did not create these spirits unclean. He had created them clean, but they fell and became unclean, just like he created men upright, but men fell and became sinful. Now, these unclean spirits are doing a foul, unclean work amongst Adam's race. And so they needed to be cast or driven out of Adam's race. Now, it says he gave them power over unclean spirits to cast them out. Interestingly, that's the same word that we had for him sending out laborers into his harvest in Matthew chapter 9 and verse 38, that I told you has almost a violent connotation of driving them out. So he said, pray that the Lord will drive laborers out into his harvest. Well, now he gives them power to drive demons, to drive unclean spirits out of those possessed with them. And here it definitely has that violent connotation of driving them out, forcing them out. Well, then he gives them authority to heal all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease. And notice that this healing he sends them to perform is in no way related to faith. He just gives them power to do it. So this healing was not to demonstrate the faith of those healed. Some people get the idea that's all healing is ever for, but no. No, this healing was to demonstrate the benefits of the kingdom of God that they were to go proclaiming. Now notice he doesn't tell them to go out looking for the sick. We'll see that he tells them to go out heralding the kingdom of the heavens. But as they're heralding, whenever they encounter the sick, or whenever they encounter those with unclean spirits, they are given the power to heal them and cast them out. So they were not being sent on a healing ministry. They were being sent to proclaim the kingdom of the heavens, but they were to demonstrate God's power and some of the advantages of that kingdom when it comes, because that kingdom will cast Satan out of his stronghold in this world, and that kingdom will heal those who are sick. And so they are healing to demonstrate their proclamation. But they were never to make money off of this, as we'll see later. This was not a healing ministry so that they could make money off of their healing powers. Absolutely not. Now we have all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease, but disease there could mean infirmities. And certainly included in that are handicaps. We think of diseases as things caused by viruses and bacteria and so forth, but this could be all kinds of handicaps as well. They are to heal all kinds of maladies. Verse 2, now the names of the 12 apostles are these. First, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother. James, the son of Zebedee, and John his brother. So now, we have the names of the 12. Now notice they're not called here the 12 disciples like they were in verse 1, but the 12 apostles. And see, what happens is that when a disciple receives a commission and is sent out on a mission with a commission, he becomes an apostle. Because an apostle is one sent, commissioned with authority. So as long as they were on this commission the Lord sent them to fulfill, they were apostles. When they came back to him and their mission was over, then they were no longer apostles, they just became disciples again, learners again, until he would commission them again with another mission. Now here we have one of several lists of the 12. And from comparing these lists, we would learn that some of the 12 had multiple names, because the lists aren't always exactly the same on the names they give. Well, that's not surprising, because most people today have multiple names. Three is generally the custom in the United States. Now, we know that most of us have a surname, kind of a family name. We call it the last name. But besides our family name, we generally have two other names. We often call a first and a middle name. And that's almost minimum in our culture. And some people will not settle on a middle name, so they have a couple middle names. So you can even have more than three names. But that was not just common in our culture, it was common back then too. But whereas we seldom ever use our middle names, they would actually use their multiple names and use different names at different times. So some of these disciples are listed by various names of theirs in the different lists. Now the list of the disciples, all of them are always divided into three groups of four, 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 and four. And the same disciples are always in the same group, either the first four, the second four, or the third four. And in each group of four, the first listed of the four is always the same, but the second, third, and fourth of each four can sometimes vary in order. So they aren't always in the same order, but they're always in the same group of four, and the first one in each group of four is always the first one in that group. So here in verse 2, we have the first group of four. First, we have Simon, who is called Peter, or Simon, as it would be in the Greek. Now, Simon means hearing. But we read, besides the name Simon, he is also called Peter. And as we learn, Peter was actually a name given him by the Lord. His given name was Simon, but the Lord called him Peter, and that's the name he's most famous for having. Now, Peter is actually Petros in Greek, and it means a stone. So his name was Simon, but the Lord gave him the name of Stone. So he was Simon Stone, we might say, or Simon Peter. Then we have Andrew, his brother. And in Greek, that's actually Andreas. Andreas, his brother. Andreas means manly. So hearing and manly were these two brothers' names. Then, besides Simon and Andreas, we have James, the son of Zebedee. In Greek, this is actually Jacobus, which is basically the name of Jacob, which, as you might remember from the Old Testament story, means the supplanter, the heel grabber, the supplanter, the one who takes another's place. Now, why in the world, if the name is Jacobus or Jacob in the Greek, why in the world is it translated James? And why do we always think of this man as James when his name was really Jacob? Well, understand that the traditional Bible of the Old Testament in the Old Church was the Septuagint Greek. You know, not many people knew Hebrew other than Jews. So the Gentile believers tended to use the Septuagint Greek of the Old Testament. And that was the traditional Old Testament that the early Christians used. So you'd say, well, it's too bad they didn't use the original, but at least in the New Testament, they could use the New Testament Greek original, right? Unfortunately, wrong. For the New Testament, they used the Latin Vulgate. So they used the Greek Old Testament, which wasn't the original, and then instead of using the original Greek New Testament, they used the Latin New Testament, which wasn't original. So originally, these names were the Latin forms, and so many of our names in our Bibles, even though the way they translate our Bibles today, they generally do translate from the originals. They translate from the Hebrew in the Old Testament and Greek in the New Testament. And that's good. That's excellent. That's exactly how they should do it. Because, of course, each time you translate, you introduce some translation errors. And if you translate twice, well, you're just going to introduce twice the number of errors. Why in the world would you do that? Always best to translate from the original. But even though they translated from the originals, they still generally kept the familiar names that were familiar to Christians. So many of the Old Testament names that we have are actually the Greek form of the names, and not the Hebrew form if we had translated them directly from the Hebrew. Whereas in the New Testament, many of the names are the Latin forms of the names, not the Greek forms, which they would have been if we translated directly from the Greek. So Jacobus went through the Latin Vulgate. Now it seems that there came about that there was a dialect of Latin that some of the priests would speak, wherein they would mispronounce Jacobus as Jacobus. If you imagine these priests reading the Latin Bible, and they're pronouncing it Jacobus instead of Jacobus. Now then it seems that they shortened Jacobus to James. And then when the J was invented, because J is our most modern letter, it was actually invented in the Middle Ages. It didn't exist back in Bible times. Well, when J was invented, they changed the first letter of James to a J, and it became James. So that is how the name Jacob turned into James. Now, it's said in England during the reign of King James that the furniture made in the reign of King James was called Jacobean furniture, not Jamesian furniture, because they realized Jacob and James are the same name. So in our Bibles, when they translated to English, whenever in Greek it said Jacobus, they translated it James. Whereas when in Greek it said just Jacob, they left it as Jacob. So that's why we have James in the Bible. But really, there are no James in the Bible. James is just a garbled translation. And the name of this man really was Jacob. And he was the son, I think, because the Greek just says James of Zebedee. I think he was the son of Zebedee. Zebediah in Greek, meaning my gift. And then we have John, his brother. Now, in Greek, that's Ioannes. But Ioannes is hard to say. We shorten it to John. It means to whom Jehovah is gracious. Now, Ioannes in Greek really comes from Jonah in Hebrew. So, interestingly, this familiar pair of disciples we all know about, James and John, we really get their names totally wrong. It was really Jacob and Jonah. Well, just like I said when I told you Mary's name was actually Miriam, but I said, seems a little point in trying to correct it here. Seems the same here. I mean, if I keep talking about Jacob and Jonah, and you don't remember this lesson, nobody's going to know what I'm talking about. Where as opposed to if I talk about James and John. So I'm going to keep talking about James and John, even though I well realized that it was really Jacob and Jonah, not James and John at all. So that was the first group of four. Then we get the second group of four disciples in verse 3. Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, James the son of Alphaeus, and Lebbaeus, whose surname is Thaddeus. So we have the second group of four. It always starts out with Philip, or Philippos, as it is in Greek. Phil means a lover of, or one who is fond of, and then the Lippos means a horse. So Philippos means a lover of horses. Always listed as the first of the second group of four. Then after him is Bartholomew, or Bartholomaeus, which means son of Ptolemy. Ptolemy meaning furrowed, like a field. Now some people think that Bartholomew, who is associated with Philip, is the same as Nathanael, who's associated with Philip in the book of John. And it was, again, a case of multiple names. And it could be that Bartholomew and Nathanael are the same. Then next we have Thomas. Thomas means a twin, although as far as we can tell, his twin was not a disciple. And then we have Matthew, the tax collector. In Greek, that's Matthios, with two THs in a row. And Matthios means gift of Jehovah. He is the publican or tax collector we saw in Matthew 9:9, who became a disciple of the Lord. And he is actually the author of this gospel. Well, that's the second group of four in the 12. Then we have the third group of four, starting with James, the son of Alphaeus. Of course, again, it's not James, it's Jacobus. Jacob, and Greek just says the of Alphaeus. Probably son of Alphaeus is correct. Alphaeus means changing. Then we have Lebbaeus, whose surname was Thaddeus. And again, that's the Latin form. The Greek form is Lebbaeus, which means man of heart. And he was given the name Thaddeus, perhaps given by the Lord, just like Simon was given the name Peter by the Lord. But Thaddeus means large-hearted or courageous. So this man whose name was man of heart, Lebbaeus, the Lord perhaps gave him the name of Thaddeus, meaning large-hearted or courageous. Then we have, verse 4, Simon the Canaanite and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. Now here we have another Simon. There are two Simons, just like there are two Jacobuses. But the Canaanite is probably an error for the zealous, because he's also called Simon the Zealot. And even though it doesn't look like it in English, in Greek, actually, zealous and Canaanite are very similar words. So probably this is an error. And Simon the Canaanite should be Simon the Zealot. And then we have Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. In Greek, this is Judas, coming from the Hebrew, Judas, meaning praise. Now, his surname is Iscariot, or Iscariotes, which means a man of Kirioth. And that probably means a man of the city. Most of the disciples, as we know, were country folk, but Judas, it seems, is a man of the city. And he is the one who betrayed him, who delivered him up to his enemies. Now, notice this. Judas is one of the 12. He's the one who betrayed him, and yet when the Lord gives them power, gives them authority to cast out unclean spirits and to heal the sick, Judas was given this same authority, just like the rest of the 12. And yet Judas was a man who didn't even believe in the Lord. So not only was the healing not based on faith, their power wasn't based on faith. Or on righteousness, certainly, since Judas was certainly not very righteous. This thief and traitor had the same power the other disciples did because God chose to give it to him. Well, of course, God can do as he likes. So in this portion, the Lord told his disciples to pray that God would send laborers into his harvest. He quickly followed this up by sending 12 of his disciples to labor in Israel. He chose these 12, and we consider these important men the Lord chose out of all his disciples. Well, these were most exalted men indeed, and we can learn from their example, and we'll learn more about their mission in our next program.
Whether the harvest is plentiful or sparse, just as Christ sent out his 12, we have the privilege to share with others all we have learned from God's Word. The response is the hearer's responsibility. The message is our responsibility. Let us always have something to share with those who would listen. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on Sending of the 12. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Matthew with Orders for the Mission. Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that this program motivates you to study God's Word more, causing you to know and love God more. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. This program has been brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry. Please visit seedandbread.org. I've been your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long for now. We look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.